Medics assemble!
I am Vedic Jackala.
And I am Vedic Bookchin. Just gonna put in a little bit of my much better alternative to the lifestyle that these people are living on this planet.
And right off the bat, we are in our regular form here for the Vedic Assembly.
We're in fine form today.
We are in fine form. We look great. We sound great. We are great.
Thank you. You do look great.
I do not. I don't have any makeup on, but thank you. my hair looks great. It's just really big. It's just like...
It does.
So...
Mine big. Looks like it is, which is I haven't cut it or dyed it or done anything to it in about 6 months.
Well, I like it though. I mean, I like the length. It looks good on you. Mm. Dave has been doing
the length too.
Yeah, Dave's been growing a pandemic protest hair, and not that he's protesting the pandemic, but he is. He's protesting the idiots that are perpetuating the pandemic when they could be vaccinating. So yeah, his hair is like down past his shoulders now, and it's so funny. Wow. He's become like a woman. He's just like constantly playing with his hair when we're recording a podcast. I love it. I love it. It works on him. So how have you been, Dr. Nick?
I've been okay. Yeah, I've been pretty good. Works good. We had a little party. Well, not really a party, a kind of on celebration in amongst our group recently, because one of the biocontrol agents that we have brought into the country was approved for removal from quarantine.
Ooh.
Yeah. And because we are all in our own quarantine, we weren't able to have an actual physical party, but at some point we will.
Nice.
So yeah, those are the kind of things that that you celebrate when you work as an entomologist in government biocontrol programs is Weevil Freedom Day.
Yeah, good. That's excellent news. Excellent news.
Yeah. And of course, we had a bloody earthquake the other day.
Oh, hell yes. I'm so sorry.
It's so weird because it's like compared to most, like there was... Thankfully, no injuries or fatalities. A couple of buildings were quite badly damaged, but that was it. But, I mean, you basically nowhere in Australia gets earthquakes with any sort of regularity. Like, we are smack bang in the middle of a very stable part of the plate. Compared to New Zealand, where, you know, they are sitting right on the plate boundary and they have volcanoes and earthquakes and all sorts, you know, it was not much compared to what they get over there, but it still registered like 6 on the Richter scale, I think, at its epicenter in kind of north central Victoria, actually really close to a place where I like to go camping called Mansfield. But like we felt it here, you know, I was in the one of the kind of outbuildings we have at work, which is a little bit more kind of warehouse-like and has sort of big roller doors and stuff. So they were like really shaking, and the people in the labs upstairs said that all of the glassware on the shelves was shaking and jingling.
Oy.
So yeah, a little bit freaky.
Oh, it's absolutely freaky. We had a 7.2 earthquake around here last March.
Wow.
And I was asleep at the time and it woke me up. It is very unsettling when the bed is shaking in a way that you have never felt it shaking before. It's kind of, it was like someone was shaking it back and forth, you know, from side to side, and all the pictures on the wall were rattling, and I'm like, don't fall down, don't fall down. So it was, I felt some mild earthquakes, but that one was very unsettling. And its epicenter was very, very near to where my younger sister Brooke lives. And in fact, in her city, there were, like, the street was totally, one of the main streets was totally broken up, pipes sticking out, lots of building damage. There was no damage to their house, thankfully, but there were so many aftershocks from that earthquake. They continued for months.
Wow.
Because unfortunately, we do have a fault line in Utah, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I know there's the big fault line down the Pacific coast.
Yeah.
And they get a lot of earthquakes in California.
Yeah. This one it's called the Wasatch Fault Line. And of course, there's also a great big caldera upon which Yellowstone sits. So.
Oh, yeah.
Someday that's going to blow.
Yeah. There is a similar but smaller area in kind of central North Island, New Zealand. I mean, obviously New Zealand is peppered with volcanoes, but there is the town of Rotorua, which is very much like Yellowstone. You have little like thermal national parks and stuff everywhere where there are just like bubbling, like boiling mud pools and geysers and all that sort of stuff. But there are even certain areas, just like little public parks and stuff around in this town, where they have a little fenced off area where there's just a hole with steam coming out of the ground. And the entire town just smells of sulfur.
Yeah. Yeah, that volcanoes terrify me. Natural disasters in general are terrifying. But volcanoes, there's just nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do. You just gotta run. Just nuts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was... have you seen this volcanic eruption that is happening in the Canary Islands? It's horrific.
Mm-hmm.
Just like... A proper, like what you'd expect when you hear, you know, volcanic eruption, just like plumes of lava flowing down over the streets and stuff.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. Lava, thankfully, is generally pretty slow, unless it's like really violently erupting. And then, of course, you get the pyroclastic cloud, which is going to kill you too, you know.
Yeah,
maybe you escape the lava, but that cloud can just burn your lungs from the inside out.
God.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a videotape when I was a kid called Shaky Beginnings. It was all about the geology of New Zealand. And it was really fascinating. And it went through, talking about various kind of recent-ish big disasters. And there was one sometime in the 1800s when Mount Tarawera erupted and completely buried a lot of the towns and villages nearby, including like this huge natural feature called the Pink and White Terraces, which were like great big stepped limestone terraces that I think there are similar ones somewhere in Turkey of a similar size, but they were huge and people actually bathed in them because they were like really, really boiling hot at the top and kind of a bit cooler at the bottom. And they were completely destroyed. And there was one Maori village that was covered in ash and then has been partially excavated and is a kind of national heritage place that you can go and visit now called the Buried Village. And you can kind of go down and still see inside some of these old houses and buildings and stuff. But they've all got just ash and kind of soil and grass and everything growing over the top of them now.
Wow. Kind of like Pompeii when they accidentally found Pompeii.
Yep.
And then what happened with Pompeii? There's a whole new village sitting on that mountain. I'm like, are you complete idiots? Whatever. Like, oh no, well, it hasn't erupted since then. Yeah, that doesn't mean it's not going to. Why would you tempt fate? Someday that
it's
baby's going to blow.
It's time.
It's going to be worse than Krakatoa. Come on. I don't know that that's true. Krakatoa was pretty bad. But
yeah,
I have a weird fascination with natural disasters. So that concludes the natural disasters portion of our podcast.
That's all right. I think it kind of leads in that we're talking about, you know, natural disasters and nature because... We're talking about the episode Paradise today. Not Paradise Lost.
No.
Paradise.
Yes, don't get them confused.
Yes. The one with a bunch of...
Luddites.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call them...
they're not low rise, technically.
I was looking up a bunch of stuff recently about anarcho-primitivism, which I'll get into when we talk about it later. I don't think they quite fit that description, but yeah, Luddites. Anti-technology Luddites. And I will get into why I don't like that view of technology as well later.
Yeah. You know,
just living on a random planet, subsistence farming, and dying of fevers.
Dying of insect bites, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have many thoughts about this episode. This was mentioned in our last episode that this is my most hated episode of Deep Space Nine. Possibly my most hated episode of Trek overall.
Oh, wow.
I don't think there are words to describe how much I loathe this episode. So, I have lots of thoughts. I mean, it's not 100% terrible. There's some great moments, too. But, unfortunately, there are not as many good moments as there are things that just make me want to go throw things at a wall just to see them break because I'm so angry. And I have a page and a half typed of notes. Yep. It's
that's
a lot.
Impressive.
I have so many thoughts.
I have three pages, but they're handwritten and they're on like a small like A5 notebook.
And that's fine. That is fine too. Because I thought about transferring these to my official Vedic Assembly notebook, and I thought there's no way I'm gonna write all of this out. This is a lot. And this is with half inch margins instead of inch margins as well. And yeah, there's a lot of swearing in my notes.
Oh, good. Mine too.
Excellent.
I have a great big all caps bullshit at one point.
Yeah. My notes actually kind of, they start off well because our little cold open thing with Sisko and, O'Brien. On the Rio Grande. See, I call it the Rio Grande because that's the actual name of the river after which it is named. And yeah, that
the Rio Grande.
Yeah, don't call it the Rio Grande. It's the Rio Grande. And that actually means, I'm not kidding, big river. That's what that means. Yeah, it has an interesting kind of, there's going to be lots of paper noises in this podcast. I did look up some things, but it's interesting, and we'll get to this. I have a little interesting information about the Rio Grande. Yeah, so, but I love the beginning because they're on this shuttle and they're looking for a place for people to settle that want to start their own colony, and they find a good M-class planet, and meanwhile they're talking about Jake having an apprenticeship with Miles, and the first time I saw this I'm like, why are you doing this, don't do that to that kid, he's not Starfleet.
he's not
an engineer.
I do like that this is still at that point where Ben is just kind of assuming that Jake is going to follow him into Starfleet.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trying to find, like, the place where he would fit.
Yeah, instead of let Jake find the place where he fits. Yeah. And this is what parents do, and I get that. And with him being a single parent as well, you know, I get it. But, you know, they have this little talk about fatherhood in general and how they grow up too fast, etc. And so... anyway, I enjoyed that part of it, and Miles does make a statement about how he found out he had talents he never knew he had simply because he didn't have a choice. It was either get all these people transported off in 10 minutes with a transporter that wasn't working, or become prisoners of the Cardassians. So he somehow got it working. But, and see, that's the thing. I don't have a problem with that particular philosophy in general. It's not really a bad thing. But purposely taking away people's right to choose is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big, big problem. And in fact, I wrote in my notes, in and of itself, this is not a bad sort of philosophy, but what comes next is one of the most meat-fisted, punch-in-the-face ways of trying to justify that philosophy that I have ever seen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, it just makes me so upset. So upset. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah, they go down to the planet. Now, here is my big what the fuck to start right off. How could they beam down if the duonetic field doesn't let technology work?
I was just going to say, why do they beam down at all if they detect a duonetic field that is, like, futzing with technology?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But especially, it's just like, how could you beam down? How could that be possible? How could the transporter get a lock on anything on the surface to which you could transport? It, right there, it makes zero sense. I consider this episode null and void because they never would have made it down to the planet via transporter.
This was, in fact, a holodeck simulation the entire time.
Yes.
I just now thinking of that has made me realize, I'm glad that Moya didn't watch this episode with me, because I think in her sort of like recently watching, you know, new Star Trek stuff with me, the thing that she sort of dislikes the most about it is all the times that Starfleet just like acts completely stupid and doesn't seem like, oh, we're just going to beam down to this like really, really dangerous situation without the right protective gear.
Yeah, and to be...
We're gonna just beam this random space whale on board without checking to see if there's, like, a pirate inside.
Yes, who will with the time crystal.
Somehow be able to take over the most advanced starship in the fleet on his own.
Every 30 minutes. Anyway...
I digress. I don't really like that episode very much.
You know, I didn't like it at first, but upon rewatch, you know, I just let the whole thing go with him hiding inside the Gormagander. And just, it's a funny episode to me. I just actually just enjoy how they do all of the repeats, how they show you different parts of the repeat every time, and how many times you see Lorca get killed. And Rainn Wilson is Harry Mudd.
That part is fun in retrospect.
Yeah, Rainn Wilson is Harry Mudd. Didn't expect to like it, because they don't like Harry Mudd, but he got me. He got me.
Mm.
I don't welcome the character, but I welcome his portrayal of the character, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does, definitely.
Yeah.
Anyway... Yeah. Speaking of characters we don't like.
Oh my god, are we going to talk about Alexis?
Fuck. See, that's the thing for me, is like, I don't think I necessarily hate this episode, and there are things that I could like about it, particularly because, for me, it shows someone like Alexis with her ideals and morals as the villain.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much.
Oh.
There's so much. Now, I have seen Gail Strickland in other things, and I never found her annoying. But in this episode, she speaks every line as if she's about to burst into tears. She's got this watery voice through the whole fucking thing. And it's not just annoying, it's distracting, and I wanted to punch her in the throat every time she opened her mouth. I'd keep her mouth shut. Oh, yeah. And as Sisko says, she seems to have something to say about just about everything. She never shuts up. Never shuts up. Ugh. And she's also kind of creepy. Like when she says to her son, oh, look, two strong men. Think of what this will mean to our community. And I'm like, ew. That sounds wrong coming out of her mouth.
Yep.
Also,
very, like, creepy cult leader vibes.
Yeah, same thing with her relationship with her son. I felt creepy about that, too. I don't know why. There was just something skeevy about it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Like, he was just this brainwashed acolyte. Yeah, I was like, please tell me nothing else is going on between us two. Anyway, it's just like, ew. Ugh. So, yeah, I mean, when we first see her, she seems all welcoming and stuff, and then she says that thing to her son, and I'm like, ugh. The first time I saw this episode, I went, uh-oh. Oh, that's bad. That's bad. Very, very bad. And yeah, it's very suspicious that they crash landed on this perfect planet and everything. Mm-hmm. And there's so much to be suspicious about. And O'Brien and Sisko are just not falling for her gunk. They're just not. It's like, you're full of shit, lady.
Yeah.
And
O'Brien's just like, I could fix this thing. It's probably pretty easy.
Yeah.
We could transport away. And she's like, don't bother. No, we've tried. Don't bother.
Yeah. And then she starts to get really irritated by them trying when Meg is dying from an insect bite.
Oh, my God.
They haven't found the right cure for. How many people has she let die for her philosophy? How many people has she sacrificed against their will for her fucking ideology?
Oh, my God. I hate it so much. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, because maybe I can get into this now. Like, this kind of philosophy, it's not quite, you know, anarcho-primitivism, because there are still sort of, like, more hierarchical, but that, I feel like any kind of, like, primitivist kind of society that's trying to like, eschew all modern technology and go back to that kind of way of life would probably end up like that anyway. It's just, because there are, like, you know, movements in real life, you know, of people like this. And, you know, I mentioned anarcho-primitivism because I'm very into anarchist philosophy, and that is one of the kind of subsects of it. And it's one that gets a lot of criticism from other areas of, like, anarchism and sort of leftism in general, because it's kind of inherently unethical. It's, you know, yeah, like, if you are taking yourself away from, like, all of the recent advances of, like, medicine, medical technology and stuff, you're going to have people dying of insect bites. It's inherently ableist as well, because, like, you know, what if someone is in any way or shape or form disabled? What happens, you know, if I'm living in that society and my glasses break? Mm-hmm. I'm useless.
Same.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, it is a, it's definitely like a hotbed issue for me, especially because I, in sort of my kind of researching and trying to figure out, like, my own kind of political philosophy and all that sort of stuff, I've found, like, there are, you know, ideals and philosophies that kind of, or you almost have the best of both worlds. The reason that I mentioned, you know, that I call myself Vedic Bookchin at the start is, you know, the philosopher Murray Bookchin came up with the idea of social ecology, which is, you know, essentially, it is an idea of, like, humanity being more in touch with nature and our surroundings, but it isn't about nature versus technology. It's about, you know, we are living beings. We are part of this world that we've evolved on. Everything that we create can and should be part of that as well. So it's about, like, it's very much linked to the modern, like, solarpunk movement and aesthetic, which I absolutely adore, because, like, even just aesthetically, solarpunk stuff looks awesome. And the whole idea of it is, like, modern sustainable technologies, like, you know, solar and wind and that sort of stuff, being used to power a, like, ethical, equitable, environmentally sustainable society. Like, that's the way that I see for, like, creating a society. If you want to be, like, closer to nature, like, you don't have to get rid of, you know, all of this modern technology. You just need to rethink how you use it.
Yeah, agreed. And that's the thing. I was talking about this with my husband, Dave. You all know Dave. And we were talking about how they actually do use a kind of technology. Mm-hmm. Because they make tools, they make clothes, etc. So
yes,
it's there's still technology being used there. But the biggest thing is, what is the end result of all of this? Because isn't the potential of humankind, which she just keeps saying man, which really pisses me off. Mm-hmm. It's like, even at that time, come on, humankind.
Yeah.
Okay, humanity. Isn't the whole thing to strive for more, to always strive for more, to not settle for what we think is possible and try to do the impossible? Isn't that really what drives change?
Mm-hmm.
And what drives humanity in general? She's taken that away from them. So what, they're just supposed to farm and weave clothes the rest of their lives? What kind of existence is that?
Hmm. And this kind of goes into like the idea that I said before of how, like, you know, they might be trying to do this sort of like anarcho-primitivist kind of thing, but it is inherently not in any way sort of anarchist or egalitarian, in that these people are all coerced into this life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's forced them into it and they had no choice.
Yeah. That is the most frustrating part of it. And so, you know, I read some stuff on Memory Alpha about, you know, the writers and how this episode was produced, etc. And interestingly enough, they were not outside. They were on a soundstage. And they had to recreate this very outside look. And I'm impressed.
Weird.
I am very impressed by that. They were basically not trying to make Alexis look like a villain, but they failed.
Oh, okay then.
And the producers do not fault Gail Strickland, and I don't really either, because she's doing the best with what she has, except for the watery voice. Mm. Please stop doing that. just don't get that. But there's so many problems, with the way she does these things. And the fact that there's no resolution for what she's done. There's no appreciable punishment, you know. And the thing is, she's big into punishment.
Yeah, it's just implied at the end that she's going to be, you know, presumably tried in the Federation courts or something like that. But yeah, we don't actually get to see what happens.
No, we don't. And she was perfectly fine with leaving, and that made me angry too. I'm just like, no, there's so much. But I want to go in a little more linear thing. Let's talk about the box.
Oh, yes. Fuck, the punishment box. God.
And also, why isn't everyone dying from skin cancer?
Yeah. Yeah. God.
So, because, you know, being out in the sun all day isn't necessarily going to be great for all people of all skin tones. And you can see that when see Miles in the fields and he's getting that ruddy, I've been sunburned sort of look, and I'm just like, oh my god, get the Celt out of there. Poor Miles. Get him out.
With his milky Irish skin.
Mm-hmm. And I know how that feels.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at myself, half of my face is literally glowing in the little, like, Zoom window right now, because mm-hmm. I've got a window next to me and it's sunny outside.
Yeah, and that's another thing. How do you protect from the sun when you're working in the fields? You don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have that scene with Miles and Ben working in the fields, and that's when we hear Ben has brothers.
Mm.
Yeah. He talks about working in his dad's garden with his brothers.
Do Do we ever hear about these mystery brothers at any other point?
I don't remember. I remember going, wait, what?
I kind of like glossed over that at that point, but I don't know if I've...
Yeah.
Maybe we're both just being bad DS9 fans.
I guess so.
And don't remember the other references to Ben's brothers.
Yeah, I don't remember any of them coming to visit him. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, when they're working the fields, that's when they find out about the box, because some guys mm-hmm. come and take someone out of the box. And that's when you find out he's in the box because he stole a candle. Okay, here's my next problem. If they share everything and everyone works for their needs, why would he in any way need or want to steal a candle? And later mm-hmm. she says to him, well, you'd just be an incurable thief. Well, if he's incurable, then why would the punishment work? So you can't have it both ways, bitch.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah. Now we get right into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If your little Luddite commune is so perfect, why do you need the box?
Mm-hmm. And they all agreed on this punishment and decided it was fair. I'm sorry, what? What? And the idea behind it is that the punishment is of a sort that if you actually do something worthy of getting you in the box, you won't ever do that thing again? Okay.
That's...
Okay. No. Just no on every level.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, yeah, and see, and I had notes about this. Later she says the box is the only punishment they have because once you've been in the box, you never repeat your crime. So why does that guy have to steal a candle if they share everything? Or perhaps he shirked his work shift. But wouldn't that have put him in the box to begin with? Or he's an incurable thief, as she infers later in the show. But again, that would have landed him in the box. So his being in the box for stealing a candle makes no fucking sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he basically, Cisco does call her the leader, and she says, I'm not a leader. They don't follow me. And I'm like, sure.
Yeah, they fucking do.
They fucking do. And you're the fucking leader, and you fucking know it. I almost said a really bad word. The word that we don't like here in the U.S. And never, ever say. And if we do, everybody goes, oh, and clutches their pearls. Yeah.
The word that people here in Australia and in Scotland seem to say all too often.
Oh, and I've heard my British friends say it a lot as well. And use it in such creative ways, both as an adjective, as a verb. I mean, almost the same way you can use fuck, but it's surprising. Yeah. It's surprising. Mm. And so, of course, Miles and Ben are horrified by this. Absolutely mm-hmm. horrified by this.
As they should be.
And now Alexis is like, well, I got to do something about this. So she sends Cassandra to Ben to rub ointment on his muscles. Played by Julia Nixon, who I know as Catherine Sakai on Babylon 5, as Sinclair's on again off again girlfriend. So, yeah, she was playing both sides of the fence back in the 90s. It wasn't a competition. It's not like you can't like both. So,
oh, dear.
So yeah, I was just like, ew. So what was she planning to get out of that situation? So, what was he supposed to like have sex with her? Maybe she got pregnant and had, you know, and that would mean he'd have to stick around out of guilt or responsibility or whatever. And So
was she just expecting him to like fall for her and just get all like doughy eyed and pacified from the sex?
Yeah, I bet that's exactly what she was thinking, which is sexism. That is sexism.
Mm-hmm.
It's sexism towards men. And yeah, and so when she explains to him why she encouraged Cassandra to come over and fuck him, he gets pretty pissed off at her. And so she decides that he's going to stand watch all night with no rest. Now, here's the thing. This is where I feel that this starts to become a racism issue, whether the writers intended that or not. Because a white woman ordering a black man to stand watch and then also telling him the next morning that he still had to work in the fields. Oh, if you don't want to work in the fields, all you have to do is just say so. And then what punishment would that incur? It's slavery. It just goes right back to slavery. And I'm like, I don't know if they intended this. I couldn't find any information about that. But that's what it feels like to me. Is this whole...
I very much got that sort of feeling from it as well. With the... just kind of the imagery, the optics of it. Of most of all, when Ben is eventually put in the box. If it were intended to have that parallel in order to cast Alexis as that much of a villain, I get it. And it was and it was certainly effective. I think it could definitely also be seen as like, in, you know, very bad taste, especially considering this, who wrote this episode?
Bunch of guys.
Yeah, a bunch of white guys.
Yeah.
So.
And that's the thing. According to Memory Alpha, they were not trying to write her or portray her as a villain. And I'm just like, okay, what?
Yeah, like, in the end of the day, that's the thing for me that just kind of kills a lot of, like, this episode for me. Because I came out of it thinking it's like, she was quite an effective villain. Because she's very hateable.
Extremely hateable. So, so, so hateable. And, you know, even all this stuff is terrible, but it's when she brings out Miles and says that he was wasting precious time.
Ugh.
Trying to get, like, his tricorder working.
Mm.
And just, she's so self-righteous, you just want to punch her. God. And
also, like, wasting precious time. Like, I feel like the only like positive of a sort of more like primitivist, you know, in heavy air quotes, because there's a whole lot of like racist undertones of just using the word primitive in that sense anyway, but the only kind of advantage I can see of a society a bit like this is that when you're just like working for subsistence, you shouldn't have to work as much as we do in our like modern capitalist world where we are working for someone else's profits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, what? They don't get time off? And it just occurred to me, what do we ever see Alexis doing for work? Do we ever see...
telling people what to do and pretending she isn't the leader.
Yeah, exactly. We don't see her in the fields. We don't see her cooking. We don't see her weaving. We don't see her cleaning up. She does nothing. She does nothing but just strut around the queen of this castle that she's created. And it's... the hypocrisy is... it's staggering. Absolutely staggering. And so, you know, that's when she's just like, oh, I know how to fix you. And she says, oh, no, you're the commanding officer and you're... crewman's behavior is your responsibility, so you're going in the box. And O'Brien's just like, no. But no, he just goes in the box. He goes in the box and she lets him out later. And she's like, I'm going to give you this glass of water if you'll put these clothes on and just join our commune. I'm like, fuck you, bitch. So, yeah. And that's basically what Cisco does is fuck you, bitch, and goes back in the box the next day.
Honestly, one of his most badass moments is just like wordlessly just goes, just it's like, I live here now. Gets back in the box.
Yep.
It's like, no. You put me in here. This is where I am now.
Yeah. Yep. And it makes me so angry. I have a really hard time being logical about this episode because it takes a lot to make me this angry. And this episode makes me really, really angry. So much. So, to finish off this particular storyline, but I do want to talk about Dax and Kira as well. Basically, Miles is like, fuck this. I'm going to find out what's going on here. And so his engineering friend, Joseph, is going to, he's like, no, she'll put you in the box if she knows that you helped me. So, basically, come look at this hematite deposit I just found. I'll make sure it doesn't hurt. And Miles being, having some ingenuity, makes a crude compass from a bowl of water with a hematite shard floating on pumice stone. And he's going to find out what the hell is going on. And he finds it. Oh,
so just like, I'd forgotten about that bit, but there are definitely like some little bits in this episode that I feel were like really well written.
Yes.
And that's one of them.
Yes.
Because, he just uses his ingenuity with, like, the kind of nothing technology that they have to make a compass.
Mm-hmm.
He's showing that, like, it's basically like, he could survive in this kind of situation if he needed to, but he doesn't have to.
Yeah. And, he uncovers the device that is causing the duotronic field. And that's when the son, what's his name, Vinod? Vinod, comes after him.
And
Vinod, thank you. And Miles tricks him by taking off his uniform. It's like, Miles, showing some leg today. Wow. And I do like that he tells the unconscious kid, well, you got one of us out of our uniform. Oh, and then he frog marches that kid right back to camp and uses his phaser to bust open the box and explains to everyone what Alexis did and how she tells them all just like she's proud of it. She's proud of it. Yes, we were always coming here. This was the way to make sure that we all followed my philosophy and made sure that we all, participated in this experiment willingly. But they weren't willing, were they? You tricked them. You made it seem like they had no choice. And you let people die. Which is, in essence, as bad as murdering them. Because you had technology that could have saved them. But...
yep.
You wouldn't allow it to be used. And the thing that makes me the most angry is when Joseph says she was right. No, she was not.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, she let people die to protect her lie and to prove her point. And what's her punishment? Oh, she has to leave the planet.
I kind of liked that that the rest of the people there decided to stay but keep the field turned off. Or I don't know, they're like, oh, maybe we'll turn it back on, we don't know. But it's like, I like to think that in their future they do manage to find that like balance between having this sort of like simplistic agrarian lifestyle but keeping, you know, the advances of technology that actually make life better.
Yeah. Well, and also there are children there. When those children are of age, they should be able to decide whether they want to stay or whether they want to know what the rest of the universe is like. Everybody should be given a choice. You know, Joseph saying that they're all just going to stay there. And I'm just like, you're not, are you speaking for everybody, pal? Because I liked you up to this point, but I just don't think you should be speaking for everybody. I think people should take a vote. And it just was all wrapped up way too quickly. You know, there should have been a lot more that went on there, especially with them finding out she'd been lying to them, that she purposely did all of these things so that she said, could say, yes, look, I did this. Ugh. She doesn't care about anyone but herself and her weird son. And even so, she would have let him die if it had proved her point. So really, honestly, does she care that much? And okay, so now let's backtrack a little bit, because when we switch back to Deep Space Nine and we see Kira and Dax talking about this admiral that's coming on board, and he's not really coming on board to talk about diplomatic relations with the Cardassians. He just wants to get Ben in a card game. And the reason Dax knows this is because she's played cards with him before. And even in two of her lifetimes, both Curzon and Jadzia, she can't get Ben to learn how to bluff. He doesn't know how to bluff. I would say that changes later on in the series. But Kira makes this noise, says, oh, that's odd. She says, yeah, I know. I've been working so... No. We just got this report. And if I remember correctly, she says from a Romulan ship. Saying that
yes,
the Rio Grande is abandoned but traveling at warp throughout the system. And
just off on its own.
Yeah. And we find out later it's because Elixis basically either she or her son transported up to the ship and set it on course for the Aurelius Minor Star. But something happened, maybe their course was wrong or whatever, and it didn't actually hit the star and burn up. So it's just kind of like just peddling around the system.
It's like...
here's one of those funny things to me is that Dax and Kira are just like, okay, let's go get it. And they just get on the little elevator and go to a shuttle pad. And I'm like, who are you leaving in charge? Who are you leaving in charge? You didn't say anything to anybody.
That's what I want to see. That's what I want to see in Lower Decks, is something like that happens, you know, and the command crew just leaves and forgets to say, like, Boimler, you have the con, and everyone's just sitting there. It's like, who's in charge now?
Yeah, because that's basically what I imagined after they left. I'm just like, wait, they literally didn't talk to anybody but each other at any point. And then they just go. Oh my goodness. So, we have a fun discussion while they're on the shuttle about how to get the Rio Grande to stop, basically. And Kira's going to transport aboard during warp. And Dax is like, no, you're not going to do that. And Kira says, well, you have a better idea. And Dax says, I'm a scientist. I always have a better idea. it's my job to have a better idea. And so she suggests they lasso. Old West term, of course, they lasso the Rio Grande.
I was just thinking that the runabout flying off on its own reminded me of in Red Dead Redemption when your horse spooks and runs off without you.
Yeah, I hated Red Dead Redemption. I just, it didn't work for me, but then I don't like Westerns, so... But I had a problem with the mechanics of the game more than anything else. It's like, okay, I'm dying every time somebody is trying to shoot at me. I don't get it. I just don't get it. Even though the game supposedly tells you how to play, it just, I'm just like, no, 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 I don't like this. Mm. This is, and that another thing that just niggles is when they lasso the Rio Grande to a stop, which is fun. They both transport over. Is that really a good idea?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you leave?
Now they're on the Rio Grande, dragging the Orinoco or whatever runabout.
Yeah.
They came on. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just that's so weird. Because surely each of them would know how to pilot a runabout. So why? Would they both have to go over? That is something that just never worked for me. Here's the thing about the Rio Grande. As I said, it is also the name of one of the major U.S. rivers. It flows from south central Colorado to the Gulf of Mexico. That is a long river. Hmm. And of course, its name, the Rio Grande River, evokes many images of days gone by in the Old West, etc. Before the white man invaded and wiped out many of the natives, and actually slaves from Texas escaped across it into Mexico, which abolished slavery in 1948. Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
Another slavery connection.
Yeah, the Rio Grande is, at least that part of it, denotes the border between the U.S. and Mexico?
Pretty much.
That's, yeah.
Part of the border. Not the whole border, of course, but...
Yeah, the bit on, like, the south of Texas or wherever. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was just an interesting parallel, because there's just this theme of slavery that they didn't intend.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, these people that she leads, she is the leader of the cult, are her slaves. They do whatever she says. They are her slaves.
Yeah.
They don't really think for themselves.
Yeah, and that's weird when you really think, because these aren't like, it doesn't sort of imply that these people are like brainwashed or, you know, they've been drugged or anything, or maybe there's some weird ergot in the grains that they've been growing or something like that that's been driving them a bit loopy. But like, these people were like, you know, Federation human colonists out on a trip. You know, they weren't all like Luddites originally. So how did this all happen? How did they all get stranded on this planet and none of the rest of them were able to figure out that, you know, the geotronic field was artificial? And like, why did they all just go along with it?
Yeah, that's another thing that bothers me, because it seems, I mean, they talk about how they spent years trying to do this and it was because of these deposits in the swamps. Did they not have any scientists there? You didn't just
dig in this one spot?
Yeah. It's like, did they not have any scientists there that knew that wasn't be the cause of a geotronic field?
Yeah. And if they didn't, what are they doing going out, you know, to settle a brand new colony on a brand new planet without, you know, any scientists or, you know, without the kind of people who could figure out what was going on in a situation like that?
Yes, I just said duotronic when I meant duonetic.
Oh, whatever.
Well, there's going to be that one listener that's like, that's not right. You're supposed to say it's duonetic. So, you know, I had to make sure that I corrected myself. But it's just... The fact, I mean, the thing is that they were going out to be colonists. So it's not like they had no intention of colonizing a world. But I think it's an insult to these people that Alexis didn't believe that they'd really put everything into this if they weren't, if they thought that they could go home at any time.
Yeah.
So she basically did not trust these people to actually do what they set out to do. And so she concocted this scheme so that they would crash land on this perfect planet and they'd have to do it. And that just, again, she doesn't really actually think that much of humanity, does she?
No, definitely not. And that goes, like, there's a little bit that I, like, a note that I wrote down with one of the things that I think O'Brien, like, reads out from Elixir's notebook, where she just says, the common conceit that the human species has evolved over the past several centuries is ludicrous. What gains we have made have come at the cost of our own core identities. Man has lost touch with his true power. And after that, I just wrote in all caps, bullshit. Because it's like, yeah, what core identities? What true power? It's like, if anything, I would say that, like, our humanity's true power is our ability to, like, create innovative and ingenious, like, technological solutions to our problems.
Exactly.
And also, technology is literally everything that we make that doesn't come directly from nature. Like, a sharpened bit of stone that we've napped off a bigger stone is technology.
Mm-hmm. It is definitely technology. The clothes that they wove, the candles they made, the tools they made, the shelter they built out of their ship, all of those things. That was technology.
Yeah. And so I have my own note after that that I say, how far up your own ass do you have to be to live in the Federation and not see the great strides of cultural evolution in the past centuries?
No fucking shit. No fucking shit. That just hits the nail right on the head. She is...
And it's like... Yeah. Even for all of its, you know... DS9 is famous for, like, bringing up the, you know, some of the problems with, like, Starfleet and the Federation and showing that it's not perfect. But even then, even considering all of that, it's like... not read a history book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's boggling. It's mind-boggling. Personally, the way that I would have liked to have seen this episode end is they put Alexis and her weird son in the box and just leave. I think that's a fitting punishment for lying to all of these people, for basically letting all of these people die because of her theory, etc. I think that she should stay in the box forever till she dies.
Wouldn't be very Starfleet,
I know.
But it would definitely have a good sense of poetic justice to it.
Well, that would be really up to the people who were staying on the planet, right?
Yeah, like, if they had just all stayed on the planet, and they'd be like, we'll bring her to justice here because she's one of us, and then they're like, okay, I guess we'll leave, and then they put her in a box.
Yeah, that's the ending I would have liked. And the fact that she just... You never see her get her comeuppance. She's always still so conceited and so up her own ass throughout the whole thing. Even when she's found out, she's still walking the walk and talking the talk like she's the greatest. Look what I helped you do. Oh, I've never wanted to punch someone so much. And this has nothing to do with Gail Strickland. I can separate the artist from the art. But just the way that she's written, she is impossible to like. Impossible to like.
Yeah. And I, like, I, you know, I'm not a big fan of, like, punishment in general. But, like, the idea that, she is still... kind of has that high and mighty air. Even when they're beaming her up to, like, face justice... She's just like, she still believes that what she did was right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what bothers me about the ending.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the best kind of ending, the best sort of quote unquote punishment in a narrative sense for her would be her actually realizing how wrong she is.
Oh yeah. I never expected that. I just, they needed to give us something, and they didn't. They didn't give us any kind of satisfaction on any level at the end of this episode. And it just really... it's so unsatisfying on so many levels. Like, the rage that it builds in me. And I will say now that after I have watched it again, I am never going to watch this episode again. Ever. 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 Because I'm going to keep these notes that I have already written. And if I ever need to talk about it...
If you ever need to talk about it again...
I have all of my information. yeah. I think that that was all of the things. But yeah, there were some things that were new to me that I just didn't notice the first two times that I saw this, which was the whole, what, Ben has brothers? And, oh, and there is this one time, like after the concubine has been, you know, tried and failed, and Sisko is confronting Alexis, and she's like, try to see it through our eyes. Do you know who says shit like that? Villains!
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
That's what the villain says when they're, like, floating up all high and mighty, doing their great big monologue before they are defeated in the end. Mm-hmm. You must see it through my eyes.
Yes, look what I have done. What you did?
I was born in the darkness.
Yes. It was... just... I don't know if I have much more to say about this episode other than I hate it. I thought maybe this time around I might have a different reaction to it, but no. No, I still hate it with every fiber of my being, possibly more so, simply because I have more perspective on certain things than I did 10 years ago, which was about the time that I saw this last, and I just...
Wow. No, I definitely think this is only the second time I've watched it as well. I like starting watching it the other week, I couldn't quite remember it, and it was only when it got up to the scene with the box where I was like, oh, I have seen this one before, because I just remembered how shitty that bit was.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing is the second they got down to that planet, which again, idiots, why did you do that? And still, how could you get a transporter lock on if there was a genetic field? There's no way you could have been down, but whatever. And she's just so happy and smiling, and I was just like, God, you are so suspicious right from the top. Right from the top. You're just too good to be true, lady. And, you know, it becomes very, very clear once Meg is dying, and Sisko's like, well, if we could get to our runabout, we could get a hypo spray. And she's like, Ben, can I see you outside? Yeah, she's from hell. Alexis can burn in that box for all I care.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That's where we're going to leave that discussion.
Sure. Yep. Oh man, that was cathartic.
Wasn't it though? It feels really good to get all that off my chest.
Yeah. I think the thing that like upsets me the most about it is that there are people in the real world who would agree with Alexis, and that like that's who I want to reach and like slap across the head and say no. Like you know, I too want to live sustainably with nature and, you know, somewhat more disconnected from, you know, social media and electronics and all of this kind of stuff. But it's like, you don't actually have to cut out all of the, like, the good parts of technology in order to do that. You can re-examine what part they play in your life and what part you want them to play in your life.
Yeah.
You don't, as I wrote in my notes, you don't have to just, like, go and live in the woods as a caveman.
Exactly. It's just, it's the extremism that I don't like about it. And the thing that I think about is that, yes, you can have your thoughts about how technology has hurt us in some ways, but I think that the good things far outweigh the bad. For instance, just in the artistic fields, that technology has provided artists with a way of digitally creating art by using the same techniques that they use in real life, but they don't have to have paint, like physical paint, and they can save this as a digital file, can send it to people, can gift it. Honestly, like, half of my Spock's behind me, because this is now my Oops All Spock's wall.
I had noticed that.
Yeah. I've been working on it for a couple weeks now. It's not finished. I still have other stuff to put up. But half of that is digitally done, digitally painted. And it doesn't look digitally painted. It looks like it was painted with real brushes, real paints. And things like that are amazing because it's not taking up other resources. Because paint is not exactly a ecologically friendly substance.
Not a lot of it, yeah.
And it's just, it seems to me that things like that are a positive part of advancement.
Yeah. Think about how much horribly worse the last 18 months would have been if we didn't have, you know, things like Zoom, you know, high-speed internet, you know, the ability for so many people to do, like, desk jobs from home.
Yeah.
And just easily keep in touch with, you know, our families and friends on a screen.
Yeah. If we couldn't play Among Us with our friends and accuse each other of being murderers. that weird little game took off during the pandemic.
I still have not played it. I really want to. I just need to get a group together, and it's really, really hard to organize.
Yeah.
A group of people who are, you know, enough people to effectively play a good game of Among Us. But I have watched a few Twitch streams of people playing it, and it looks awesome.
My favorite...
Played the hell out of some Minecraft,
though. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I used to play it heaps beforehand, but within like the first month or two of lockdown last year, my best mate Will just messages me. He's like, "Hey, they've started like cross play with Minecraft now, so if we can like play it online on our PS4 and you can log into our world on your computer." And we did it, and like, so that, yeah, like Will and his partner and Moya and me, we were just like on there creating our great big block world together. Still play it every now and then now.
Yeah, Dave and I have played co-op quite a bit to help each other get achievements or trophies, because we have both have PlayStations, so they're trophies. But he's like, "I've got to throw diamonds at you." And I'm like, "What?" He said, "It's a trophy I need to get." Because he loves getting trophies. I don't care about the trophies, honestly. I just don't. But he said, "Okay, so we finally got logged into the same game. I came into his world. And they put me in a completely different place. Like, I was so far away from where he was." I'm just like, "Oh, why? Why did you do that?" And so I had to head towards him. But luckily... I noticed they have this thing that you can turn on now in your settings called coordinates. So,
oh yeah,
that is extremely helpful.
Yeah, I have coordinates on in our own little game that I just play with Moya. Will unfortunately seems to be averse to turning on coordinates in our big game that we play together. He kind of does like to do a few things on hard mode like that.
Well, the thing is, I would often, especially with how big the worlds are now, they're just gigantic. Oh, yeah. It used to be that you had a choice of small, medium, and large. Not anymore. But
no, now it just goes on forever.
Forever and ever and ever. And so, I have to write down where I live.
Oh, yeah. I have. In one of my many notebooks sitting next to me, I have pages of, well, not pages, but lines and lines of different Minecraft locations of where interesting things are.
Yes. Yes. Dave.
This is where the ocean monument is.
Yes.
This is where the stronghold is.
Dave just randomly found this really cool world where he started out in this sort of southwestern desert. And I thought it was so cool. And he said,
let the Badlands biome.
Yes. And so he said, I'll give you the coordinates so you can play in the same world. And my world turned out slightly different, just slightly. But it still started me very close to this big area. And I just had so much fun in that area. But and that was that was a really nice aspect of it. One of my favorite things is just building houses in like every place. It's like, oh, this is a new area. I'm going to build a house here. And then and I always have food on me. I play on peaceful mode so that I don't have to worry about starving to death or being killed by enemies because that's just really fucking annoying. And I'll build this this pen for sheep and then I'll get some grain and I will go out and start luring sheep to my pen and then I will dye them different colors and get different colors of wool. And it's hilarious. And there was one time where I went out to get one sheep that I had already turned their wool red, so they were easy to find. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, there's another one over there. So I go over there and get that one. I trailed six sheep back to my pen in one go. Ah, dear. Minecraft is great.
It's so much fun. I've been spending a lot of time watching the guys from Hermitcraft on YouTube as well. Just like watching the worlds that like 20 professional like YouTube Minecrafters create when they're just in a server together. It's spectacular. They'll build this giant castle thing. And I'm like, wow, God, I'd love to be able to build something like that one day. And they're like, well, that's my starter base done. Now I'm going to start planning on my mega project.
Wow. Just wow. Mm. I don't have that level of skill. I'm very boring. When it comes to building things, Dave will look at house plans and then build them in Minecraft. And I'm just like,
nice.
I don't have that level of skill and I'm okay with it.
We just, our biggest project was trying to get enough obsidian to build a giant, like floating crystal shard, which is about 100 blocks tall.
Wow.
I put a creeper farm inside
of
it.
Of course you did.
It's got to do something.
Of course. Of course.
Couldn't possibly just sit there and look awesome.
No. No. That's too simple. Absolutely too simple. All right. Well, that's that was an interesting turn.
This has been Minecraft talk.
Yes.
The Minecraft Assembly.
Minecraft Assembly. Also, the most fun that I've had watching streams on Twitch for Among Us is the AEW wrestlers playing it. And
oh, that would be really fun.
Evil Uno usually heads that up. I love Evil Uno with a passion. He's one of my favorite people on this planet because he's delightful. Despite his name, he's delightful. And last week it was Mrs. Uno's birthday. And so they got a bunch of friends together to play Among Us online. And it was... It's also funny. You can find a lot of the streams on YouTube as well. So you don't have to watch them on Twitch. But yeah, you just find Evil Uno on either Twitch or on YouTube and have some fun watching everybody kill each other.
Oh, I'm going to look him up.
It's so much fun. They're just, it's just funny. Having a good time.
Nice.
Excellent. So I guess the only thing left is to do the thing we do.
Is to do the thing we do.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Nick. Hey, Nick. Yeah. Hey, Nick. Hey, Nick.
Yeah.
Where can people find you?
Well, lots of places.
Okay. Well, I mean, where can they...
Not that many places, really.
I mean, where, not where they can find you. Not physically, but like... Sorry.
You can find me on Twitter at Punk Zoologist, and at what not on earth. And on Instagram, Punk Rock Zoologist. And that's it, isn't it? Yes. Where else am I? God. I have a LinkedIn.
No. LinkedIn no. is of the devil.
It reminded me the other day that I've been like working at my current role for a year now. Ooh. Which is just astonishing. But yeah, because like I finished my PhD last July and then started working last September. And it's like, you've been working here for a year. And so I get all the little congratulations messages from everyone who follows me.
Aww.
Including my dad, which is weird. It's like, why don't you just text me, Dad?
Your dad follows you on LinkedIn and sent you a message about congratulations for a year. Okay. To each their own. To each their own. It's fine. It's fine.
So, Brandy, where in the world
is Carmen San Diego?
Online things.
Sorry.
You'd rock a big red fedora.
I would, and a trench coat. I think I would make a great Carmen San Diego. But that's just me.
You made a pretty awesome Loki variant.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
That was your cosplay from FanX?
Yes, that was from FanX. I did go to a convention. Everybody had to wear masks, and they were protecting the celebrities. So, yeah.
One of the like funniest things I've seen cosplay-wise recently, this is a big tangent, but it's because your costume was a Loki variant. I saw someone had gone to a convention dressed up as like with like the horns and like the sort of Loki colors, but it was also a Delta Airlines like flight attendant uniform, so they were the Delta variant.
That is genius. That is genius. Oh my god.
Oh dear.
That is genius. Oh, wow. Yeah, I felt very powerful in my Loki outfit. It will get used many times because had a really good time. And, you know, it really incorporated my resting bitch face as well. So it just, you know, I didn't have to worry about, do I look like I'm angry right now? Of course I'm angry. I'm a Loki. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I was worried about how to, because I had a green cape and I didn't want it to be the whole, yes, I'll just tie this at my neck and wear this. No, don't like that. And so I thought, how can I possibly attach this to my top that I was wearing that it wouldn't come off? And I did it with big magnets, big flat magnets.
Oh,
so I attached with Gorilla Glue and 3M adhesive these magnets to the inside of the cape, and then I had Dave help me put it on, because there's right in the back of the top that I was wearing there was a Loki symbol, and so he knew, okay, that's the middle, that's where the middle magnet goes. And so he'd put a magnet under my shirt and then attach that to the cape to that thing stayed on and did not move all day long.
Nice.
Even when Dave stepped on it, which he did several times, it did not move. So, ingenuity with magnets.
Awesome. Like making a compass out of hematite.
Exactly. Because you need magnets for that. Hematite, magnetic. There you go.
So, where can people find you online?
You can find me places. The easiest thing is to just follow me on Twitter at Brandywine12. Brandy's with an I, 12 is a number. Y'all know this by now. But if there's a new listener, now you know it too. And I do other podcasts like Boldly Go, a Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast, which has kind of fallen into a pit of loneliness because Suzanne, my co-host, has been in the process of moving for like 2 months. So I'm going to bother her soon and say, hey. hey, look, we had Star Trek Day and stuff, so maybe there are things we could talk about. Oh,
God, you guys have got stuff to talk about.
We still have stuff to talk about.
I got so much more emotional about that cast announcement than I expected myself to.
I lost my mind. I truly did.
Yeah.
And I was watching it live, so... Yeah, Dave wasn't watching it, and he kept hearing me going, "Oh my god!" You know, stuff like that from the other room, and he'd be like, "Okay, she'll just be peeking around the corner in a minute to tell me about it." So yeah, so I do that, and I do What the Future Holds, which is Star Trek Discovery podcast. And we've kind of been on another little mini hiatus while our good friend Chris is in another state doing a production of Kinky Boots. He is the music director.
Oh.
So, cool. Yeah, he has been very busy with that. They're at the point where they're about to open. So, wow. Yeah, he's so proud of the cast. And he's very excited.
I'm so happy for him. I'm so glad that theater is happening again.
Yeah, it feels I mean, that's his bread and butter. That's his life.
Yeah.
And so he said it felt so good to be working again, and I'm like, dude, I'm so glad for you. So we've been on a bit of a break for that, but we'll get back to it. And then Infinite Trek sometimes happens. I never really know when. The Unready Room on Friday nights. We've moved to Friday nights with Dan and sometimes Bruce. And that's on Dan's YouTube channel, which is Kurt Ratz Productions. Kurt Ratz is Star Trek spelled backwards. And we talk about Star Trek. We're covering Lower Decks right now. We'll be covering Prodigy when it starts. And then we'll be covering Discovery when that starts during Prodigy. That's going to make things really interesting for the Unready Room.
Oh, my God. It will.
Yeah. So... And then I do a podcast with Dave called Dark Corner Podcast. We talk about nerdy things from a darker point of view. And we're going to have even more stuff to talk about because we have reinstated movie night, which is something we used to do a lot. And then we started doing improv on weekends, and a lot of our time was taken up. And we have retired from improv because we are having more fun doing podcasts and stuff. So, yeah, we now have Saturday night movie night again. And we're starting that tonight. So exciting. Anyway, those are all the places that you can find me. And I'm starting to do that Kristen Week thing again, where she's the person who has to one up everyone else and play with her hair. Sorry. I was doing that before the podcast started, guys. Nick understands. Nick understands.
All right. Well, and before we close up today, I wish to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which I live and work and where I'm recording now, and I acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded, and I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. So, finally, there is nothing else left to say but Vedix, disassemble! If you want to know more about the weird philosophical stuff I talked about today, look up Murray Bookchin, Social Ecology, and Solarpunk, because it's all cool.